Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration, collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my interview today is with Bronwyn Hughes. She's the director of The Journey is the Destination. It premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival this past September in 2016. And Bronwyn and I were not able to connect there, and I'm so glad that we were able to spend time together on Skype today. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. You're going to love the film, The Journey is the Destination, about war journalist Dan Eldon. You'll find out all the information you need to on the website. We've got a few links there that you're going to want to check out, but Bronwyn and I talk, you know, we talk about the film, but we talk about, you know, we talk about splash and ripple effect. We talk about this idea of no sense of the other. We talk about this global tribe of people who get it. And I guess, some of those who don't. We talk about creativity and wonder and about inspiration. And we talk about things like a journalistic voice. And Dan certainly had a very distinctive one, a very passionate one. And here was a guy who was just so taken by this childlike sense of wonder and desire to change the world. The phrase that I love so much that Bronwyn used was, quote, a life of crowded hours, close quote. How cool is that? Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my podcasting. We're coming up on 300 interviews soon. We're going to have a special guest. And don't forget, too, rabble.ca for more information there as well. And if you want to support the work that I'm doing through Face-to-Face, you can do that. Links to Patreon on the site. Coming right up, Bronwyn Hughes and the film The Journey is the Destination. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by a very special guest today, Bronwyn Hughes. And this time, I'm not in Toronto. Bronwyn's in Toronto. I'm in Cambodia. So how cool is that? We're here today to talk about her new film, The Journey is the Destination. Bronwyn, thank you for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Not a bad connection for about, what is it, 12,000 kilometers?
Well, you sound like you're in my living room, so it's working.
It seems to be working out pretty well. Let's hope that plays out for us. So, first of all, right out of the gate, congratulations on the film. Thank you for that. Really enjoyed it. What a story. What a remarkable, heartbreaking, tragically beautiful story.
Well, the truth is that I came across a story years ago. We're trying to downplay how many years, but it's really been a long journey. But once you know about this story, it never gets its hooks out of you. So we couldn't let it drop until we've made the film.
So is it correct to assume it was the world premiere at Toronto International Film Festival this past September?
Yeah, and it was also the first time I'd ever seen it with an audience. It was just kind of frightening and exhilarating all at the same time. But in the world of premiering, especially independent films, there is no better or bigger venue than the Roy Thomson Hall Gala that we were honored with. So it was pretty thrilling.
And what kind of reception? Good questions, good feedback? Were people engaged?
Well, it's a very emotional roller coaster ride of a movie, so I am aware of the people with the sounds of sobbing right. around me.
Right.
This is total spoiler alert, but towards the very emotional ending, I know that there's that kind of response. We had a standing ovation, and there's 1,100 people in that room, so
wow.
That's a lot of energy. And there's no Q&A at a TIFF gala. But I am sometimes, actually since TIFF, been to a few film festivals, but I do have this repeating experience where people who saw the film sort of, chase me down in the street the next day. And I was just in Manchester in the UK when this girl came to me and she said, I couldn't speak last night. I couldn't ask a question. I couldn't find my voice. I just went to a bar and sat there alone and have just recovered to talk to you now. But, I think... to move people in any way is kind of rewarding. Mm. And somehow that's what this story does.
So you must have learned, I know Dan's mother was very involved in the project in a huge way. And I've had the opportunity and the pleasure of interviewing her, Kathy, about 5 or 6 months ago. It was a delightful conversation. We had a great, great interview. But, I'm kind of interested... You must have learned a lot about Dan, his family and friends and those around him. Where does this kind of, he's really at home, and it really comes out beautifully in the film. He's really at home helping others, wanting to help others, reaching out to others who I would probably argue most of us don't even give a second thought to, really, or even a first thought in some cases. Where does that kind of, global awareness or curiosity or... desire to change the world come from? It always, I find it so affirming and encouraging and marvelous, but also on another level, really deeply challenging.
Well, I think that there's no doubt that Dan grew up in a family with Kathy Eldon and Mike Eldon as the parents, in which there was no sense of other, meaning, people of all kinds of races and creeds and from the four corners of the earth would show up at the Kathy Eldon households. So the kids grew up sort of interested and curious about every kind of person in every corner of the world, like we say. I think it's infectious. So it became sort of natural, I think, as a way of moving through his travels, that he would arrive in a completely strange place but find some common connection, And I think that... getting close to people was what made him a good journalist. He really just had a people skill, but an insatiable curiosity about things, that he would encounter. I think that the people who find his story get it too. We talk about it being a global tribe of people who find Dan's story and think, my God, that's the life I always meant to lead. And we even get, leading up to the film, we would get letters all the time from people who say, I just found this book and read about Dan and I'm changing my life. I'm giving up my dead end job. And I'm going to, for example, one woman went to the Amazon to build freshwater wells and she's still there doing it now.
Wow.
And the kids he took on safari, the first half of our film is what they call the STA Student Transport Aid Safari, where he got together 16 kids, or actually there's less than that in the film because we couldn't fit them all in, but he got together a bunch of kids from the international school. So, from all over the world, and they raise money by throwing concerts and selling jewelry and art and dances, and then hand delivered it after driving across 5 African countries in 2 Land Rovers, hand delivering it to the refugee camps, and it changed all of the lives of those kids. So, and they wrote about Dan, expanding their horizons and making them see that they were capable of things they never would have dreamed possible before knowing him. So I think that's the kind of effect he has on people, whether they knew the live him or have just read his super vibrant journals now. People think they've met him when they've
right.
never met
right.
him at all.
Well, you really get that sense in the film, the way the character's developed and the way he plays it. the act, Ben, what's his, Ben Schnetzer, is that right?
Ben Schnetzer.
Yeah.
Our father.
Yeah, delightful. Really, really well done. I love the way the film starts and how, you know, right out of the journals, he sort of asks the question, you know, where do I start? Safari's a way of life. He makes some really beautiful, you choose some really beautiful phrases, you know, want to record with the eyes of a child. I mean, it's just so delightful. The mystery, the wonder, the desire, right? To know and to dig in, I guess, to dive in is almost a better way. But I thought it was really delightfully ironic. Where do I start? And yet he's already started. He's already in, you know, he's in such a big way. It's beautiful.
Thank you. But, I mean, the credit goes to Dan. I mean, we used as many of Dan Elden's own words as we could, infused into dialogue when it made sense. But his journal voice, which is this, you know, acid-tongued, witty, funny, insightful kind of voice scribbled on the margins of his journal books, that's, I think, what you're talking about in the opening sequence. His mission statement for Safari as a way of life kind of informed every decision we made. So I thought it was the right thing to start the movie like that, but also start with his visual language too. We've made this film look like the mixed media journal pages as much as we possibly could. And in that sense, it doesn't look like most other films.
So Bronwyn, is it fair to say, would you say this, and I don't want to be, and it's going to probably come across as judgmental, but I hope not. It's more of a question of kind of, you know, you talked a little bit about this global tribe before the recording started. We had talked about the global tribe or global cult of people who kind of get the message behind a film like this, who kind of understand already, you know, that whole preaching to the converted thing. You know, there's you know, Dan did start. A lot of people talk about starting. A lot of people talk about getting involved, and they don't. And they move on, and they, whatever, they turn a blind eye. There's a great moment in the film where I think he's in a journalist's office in the UK. He walks by a television, sees an image, and he just sort of mumbles, something should be done about that. And the reality is he gets involved, right? And I'm always fascinated by that. Any insight there?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very repeating thing that people find Dan's story, like I've said, and are inspired by it. And I've been trying to analyze all this time on why, because you can't really pinpoint, you know, he didn't single-handedly save the world, you know,
right.
You know, so what is it about Dan that people find so inspiring? And I have basically boiled it down to this, which is that Dan did what was possible in his own sphere. He didn't single-handedly take on the job of, you know, stopping the war in Somalia or some giant thing like that. But he changed the lives of the people who were close to him. And then they were changed by that and also passed along that same instinct and so on and so on. So I often talk about Dan's life like a pebble you drop in the ocean and the ripples keep expanding and expanding and continuing. Yeah. And I really think that people find it doable to do something in their own sphere like Dan did in his, you know, not to carry the weight of the world on your shoulders, but to change what needs changing in your own little bit.
Yeah, it seems to me, you know, I've been teaching in international development for years at Humber College. I do one course a year and postgraduate students who want to change the world. And it's really interesting to see how sometimes the cynicism can really set in. And by the time they're done the program, and these are students that have already done a political science degree or maybe a development degree, and they just go, you know what, it's too big. I'm out. I'm going to go get a job at the Royal Bank.
Oh, no, that's terrible. Well, they have to talk about Dan. They have to read about Dan's story because, you know,
right.
From a very young age, he was doing things like this. We couldn't work everything into a movie. For his short time on this planet, it was such a life of crowded hours. And I know about a story when he was still in high school that he met a girl in the Mathari Valley, which is the slums outside Nairobi, who needed a heart operation but couldn't afford it. And so they threw a big dance, you know, with people who wanted to go to a dance, and with that money they paid for the operation. So I also talk about Dan, what Dan does is kind of a stealth operation. And in fact, I hope the film is too. And what that means to me is that he ropes you into his grand adventures because it's something you want to do anyways. Like you want to go to a dance, or you want to go on a teenage road trip sex safari, you know.
Right.
It's not hard to convince people to come on an adventure like that. But by the end of it, you've actually been doing something incredibly meaningful and possibly world changing, but it didn't feel like a bitter pill, you know? And in making the film, I hope to sort of adopt that same thinking, which is, I don't want to make a lesson movie. I want to throw a grand adventure. And I hope you come because you too want a grand adventure. And maybe if by the end you think differently, mission accomplished, you know?
There's a beautiful scene with the buffalo where you really start to understand, I think anyway, as much as a film can make you understand this, empathize and so on with individuals and characters. And in this sense, you're telling a true story, whatever the heck that means. But anyway, he says he wants to see what he's thinking when he's taking a selfie with this, you know, old school camera. And as a philosopher, I mean, really appealing to me on so many levels, but I mean, clearly the heart of a child in a sense, and I don't mean immature. I mean, just this desire to know, this, like, we, you know, this curiosity. Once again, I want to see what my thoughts are. And then, and more importantly, then I want to reach out and communicate that to others.
Yeah, the buffalo image and, you know, phrases about buffaloes or witticisms about buffaloes shows up a lot in Dan's journals, because he did have a crazy story one day of being chased by a buffalo through the bush and losing his flip-flops en route. It's called Patapateo. We've mixed it in a little bit through the film. You know, this sort of the adrenaline rush of it, I think, was a revelation to him. But surviving it, of course, is always incredibly juicing. And actually, the funny story about shooting that scene is when the animal wrangler the production calls an animal wrangler saying, you know, read this script. We need to get some animals in here and check the buffalo scene. She closed the script and she said, "Not going to happen. Africa's most dangerous animal. Think of another one." So I was determined to honor Dan's buffalo, and I myself shot those ultra close-up shots of the most dangerous African buffalo by sitting cross-legged quietly on the floor and waiting for the buffalo to get curious about me.
Oh, wow. That's hilarious. And I
had buffalo drool on my lens to prove it.
Wow. Okay. There you go. I can safely say that's the first time coming up on 300 interviews on Face to Face. I don't think I've ever had a chat to anyone about buffalo drool before. So we're breaking ground everywhere, Bronwyn.
Excellent.
So do you feel like, in some sense, as a director of such a huge story, I mean, you must have felt a certain responsibility to Dan, to the family. But also, I'm kind of wondering, do you feel like you were able to do it in 2 hours, or did you need to think about a sequel?
Oh, man. You know, the hard part with Dan's life, we were saying, is such a life of crowded hours, but to make those judicious choices of what to fit in, you'd think it would fit in easily when someone has a short time on the planet, but it didn't. And then you have this other problem, which you're sort of hinting at in your question, which is that people are passionate about Dan for different reasons. Right. You know, someone will come to me and say, "My gosh, those travels he made with the student transport aid, you know, inspired my life." And then someone else will come and say, "My gosh, the relationship with his mother is so true to my heart." And someone else will say, "I've always wanted to be a war journalist and be in the heart of the action." So which one do you pick, man? You know, which do you give the precious screen time to? And it was really difficult. Ultimately, I think I just had to filter all, you know, as you listen to people's input or desires, you have to filter it ultimately through a filmmaker's eye that, you know, hangs it on a central spine moving forward in a dramatic way. And so, you know, you listen to everybody, and then by osmosis, you have to make it sort of percolate and come out whole, you know. And I don't think there's a right or wrong. Some people will say I might be wrong, but it was the best I could do to sort of assimilate the passions, right, that people were expressing.
Right. Yeah, it must be really challenging. I mean, you know, writing a book about it, you could have written 300, 400, 500 pages, but doing a film, you've only got so much room and so, as you say, so much ground to cover. I think it's a wonderful testament, not only to, you know, the story, but kind of the metaphor for change, it seems to me. You know, you talked about that pebble, the splash and ripple effect. I mean, it really is beautiful, and it's so telling, but, you know, short life, but incredible impact.
Yeah, I think people read about Dan now, and like I say, they write letters. We get letters every week still from all over the world, and they talk about Dan kind of like, you know, he's still around. It's more people inspired by the life he lived, not the fact that he died. In fact, that would be a cautionary tale, which is the opposite of the point of making the movie. You know, it's a movie about the way he lived, and I think people caught on to that.
Do you think that he was, I mean, you sort of touch on this a little bit, I guess you could probably say a lot. Any war journalist, it seems to me, must be, you know, you talked a little bit, there was one character who talked about, you know, seeing into the belly of the beast. There's, you know, there's something that forces you deeper. You know, you can't not come back. You can't not return. There's an adrenaline there. And I don't know. So anyway, I'm wondering, Dan, was very much a thrill seeker, I suppose. He was a skateboarder. He was a surfer of a very particular sort. but you know, he just didn't stop at the dyed hair and the Vans skateboarding shoes. He decided that he was also I'm going to use the word arrogant enough to change the world.
Well, you know, I think that first of all, he was a slightly different breed of war correspondent, war journalist. After Dan's time in Mogadishu, his sister Amy made a film called Dying to Tell the Story, which is about frontline journalists and what drives them to do what they do. And some kind of dismiss that job as thrill-seeking adrenaline junkies.
Right.
But I do think that there is something that seems impossible to fathom if you've been in a situation like that and you come home and someone says, okay, now you need to do a desk job. I can't really fathom that someone would be able to make that kind of, you know, to leave it behind. But it's not just that it's adrenaline. I think that once you know something so usually devastating,
right,
hopefully with, you know, possibility in it exists out in the world, isn't that job never ends, you
right,
know
right.
So I think you have to keep till people sit up and take notice, you know, and they do talk about that in the film. The characters talk about that in the film. I think Dan was slightly different than the other journalists in that his true interest was people, you know.
Right.
In his travels he would want to meet whoever he could and, you know, make friends within seconds and find common ground and something to talk about and make fun with. And as a journalist, he got closer to the people of Mogadishu and Somalia, who would invite them into their houses, and therefore he'd get, of course, incredible pictures, incredible portraits. The other journalists would warn him against getting too close, and maybe you could say that he got way too close to the flame, but in terms of bringing the Somali voice to the world, that's what it takes. They can't just be a faceless mass of suffering people, you know?
Well, I think, you know, it's really interesting your comment about going into people's homes. I mean, not only did he take pictures of people's faces, he actually, you know, looked into people's faces, if that makes any sense. You know,
yeah,
and you really communicate that. He cared about people. He wasn't there just for the Newsweek cover. He wasn't, you know, he was there for the Pulitzer Prize. He was there because, as you said earlier, just to kind of come back full circle, he didn't really see an other in a negative sense. You know, we're all in this together, kind of. You got a great little piece of a great little moment, I think, during a battle scene near the end of the film, and the graffiti on the wall: consultation, not colonization. And it's just, to me, that's what Dan's life, it seemed anyway, was really all about, or at least you communicate that, this idea that, it is about others. It is about listening. It is about our neighbors, and we're all in this together, you know. And I continue to see that as a thread in the filmmakers that I interview and the writers, and I'm encouraged by it. But yeah, consultation, not colonization. We got to listen better.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you for noticing so many details in the movie.
Oh, you're welcome. It's
a prize. You get the prize. It's really impressive.
Oh, nice. So well, listen, I no problem at all. It's I love doing it, but I love those details because they matter.
Well, that, you know, details is the filmmaker's job, but we have a team of people in every department adding to that desire.
So yeah, would you say was Dan a good listener? Because you know, I think he certainly. You also have that sort of scene where, you know, he's the only one who wants to move forward, and everyone is kind of like going, "Okay, we're done here. I'm out. This is now. We've now crossed a line." And yet, he didn't seem to feel like there was a line. Almost, you know, you mentioned him getting a little too close to the flame.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what I do think that scene is about, and maybe, you know, at the core of Dan's character, is curiosity, you
yes.
know? And of course, it's a big world, and you can never really know what makes everybody tick. So that curiosity, if it never gets squelched, continues to drive him. And, you know, how do you just say, okay, I've seen enough, I'm done. I know it. I'm out of here. You know,
right.
It's just, there's no end if you have curiosity, healthy curiosity, hopefully.
Well, yeah. And I think it's, you know, Dan strikes me well as the kind of guy that was trying to shock other people out of their complacency. He was never complacent in his life. And that is fascinating to me for somebody at such a young age. You know, it makes me want to ask questions like, you know, how was this guy raised? What school did he go to? Tell me more about his friends and his sister. I want to know what books he was reading. You know, what is it? What were those little pebbles that were dropped into his life? You know, clearly his parents, clearly his, yeah. the culture he grew up in. But I find it really fascinating and really encouraging, actually.
Well, you've met Kathy Elden. You've talked
yes,
to Kathy Elden.
Indeed.
So you'll find fire and spark there.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
a big part of the equation.
That's an understatement. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, she's amazing. Mike Elden, if you meet him in still living in Kenya, he's amazing. He writes these Christmas letters where he says what he's been up to in the year. You read the letter and you just wonder why you are sitting on your couch when someone is doing so many inspiring things.
Right.
But I also do think that growing up in Africa, where they had like apparently two television stations, maybe three in the 90s, and cell phones and internet, they would do things and they would throw costumes to go to the supermarket because it was, you know, creative and adventurous. And that kind of energy feeds itself. And then people want to be a part of that. I, you know, over and over again, you hear of people who knew Dan or met Dan and ended up sort of going to the desert for 12 hours, you know, or
right.
flying with his best friend to Moscow for a day. So,
right.
You know, do not rest because there's too much to see.
Do you, Bronwyn, do you think that, Dan would be cynical today, looking at the world, looking at the news, Donald Trump's America, what's going on? We're back in the middle of another famine, it seems.
Identical headlines now from Somalia than Dan's time.
It's really remarkable, right? Kind of what goes around comes around. I certainly have a few friends that are deeply cynical about where the world's heading, but I choose not to be one of those people. I mean, I call myself a hopeful cynic. Where do you think Dan would lie today? I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's not a fair question, but yeah, I'm just interested to know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is also darkness in Dan's journals where you realize that he's not just coasting through on, you know, some happy pill or something.
Right.
I think he would be not very happy with the state of things right now if, you know, because so much of what he believes in is flipping to the dark side. But if anybody can pass through the way of hope, which is the goodness in people, it's Dan. I think that was his number one skill, finding the goodness in people.
Restoring hope, which also ironically comes out in the film.
Oh, good.
Yeah. You know,
yeah,
I guess we're coming close to wrapping up our conversation. Maybe we can do a part two. Hey, can you tell us what's coming up in the near future for the film and for you? You've got a couple showings, one in Toronto in particular.
Yes, I am very excited. The film is going to show this Sunday, May the 7th, as part of Contact, which is a fantastic citywide photography and art festival that happens every year, but in conjunction with the Art World Gallery. Am I getting that name right? Uh-oh. Art World? Can you tell me? This is the editing part. Is it Art World?
No, I think that's right. And we're going to put it up online anyway, so we got to cover.
Okay, good. In conjunction with the gallery showing of Dan's photographs, we are screening the film this Sunday, May 7th, and there so far seems to be a big crowd, but myself, producer Kathy Eldon, and producer Marty Cates are going to be there for Q&A, question and answer period after, and I hope it's a lively discussion.
No, it sounds
great. Perhaps it will be boring.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be a very lively discussion, and I wish you well with that. You know what? Let's maybe kind of wrap this up with and I'd love to do a part two with you down the road. But one of the lines Dan used or spoke to somebody, and I can't remember in the film, he talked about opening people's eyes, and that's clearly what his life was all about, as not only as a journalist but as a just as a human being. Part of this global tribe that we live in. But I love the way he said, it's the only thing I can think of to do. And that, clearly, that splash and ripple effect is going to resonate for quite some time.
I'm glad those words are sticking with you, because I think that's the core of his character.
We've been talking today to Bronwyn Hughes, director of The Journey is the Destination. Again, we had a full connection, a long 30-minute connection here, Bronwyn, for 12,000 kilometers apart. Not bad, eh?
Amazing.
thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much for taking interest.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.